Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Cohen's Corner. And we have another very special guest from the Mets world on our episode this week. You probably have heard him on the radio talking Mets with Wayne and a couple of games with Howie as well sometimes this year. He's one of the newest voices of the Mets on 880. We have Jake Eisenberg with us this week, and we're so excited to chat with him about his work in broadcasting. He's a lifelong Mets fan who grew up in Port Washington, which is where I'm also from. We're going to get into that as well. And he's currently serving as the fill-in radio broadcaster for Mets games on WCBS 880. And he currently lives in Omaha, Nebraska, where he maintains his current role as the play-by-play broadcaster for the Omaha Storm Chasers, which is the AAA affiliate of the Kansas City Royals. So we're going to talk about his work with the Mets, his work in minor league broadcasting, his time growing up as a Mets fan like the rest of us. And yeah, I can't wait to chat with him. So thank you, Jake. And it's not going to be confusing at all because we have two Jakes, so don't worry. But welcome, Jake. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. And great to reunite with you after all these years. It'll be fun.
Yeah, exactly. So before we get started, or I guess getting us started. So one thing Jake and I like to ask all of our guests is kind of, you know, take us through like how your Mets origin story. So like how you became a Mets fan, what was kind of maybe some of your earliest memories of the Mets, and what was kind of like maybe a seminal moment of your early fandom that got you cemented for life?
That's an interesting question because I was born in 1995, so I was 5 years old when the Subway Series happened, and I truly don't have many natural memories of the Subway Series. You know, I've gone back and watched the games, and it's hard to tell what I remember from when I was five and what I now think I remembered after watching them, you know, as a little bit of an older person. And so that would be like the best origin story, right? It's like, oh, the Mets were in the World Series. I was 5 years old. This is great. The truth is that the team that was probably the team that I latched onto the most was the 2006 team. I was 11 years old. The team was great. David Wright was awesome. They went to the National League Championship Series. I forget exactly how that ended. But definitely won the whole thing. It was a really exciting season. And it also happened to coincide with the first year that games were on SNY. So they were, you know, a little bit more available to me in a way that I could find them, you know, as an 11-year-old. And so I remember watching all those games and listening to all those games. And that was probably the first year that I watched or listened to a majority of the games during the baseball season. But when it comes to, I guess, my origin story as a Mets fan, I remember going to games when I was, I don't know, 6, 7 years old. We'd go to Shea Stadium. We'd take the train over there or we'd drive over there. And we'd sit in the orange seats at Shea, the field level seats on either the first base side, or the third base side. And Mike Piazza was my favorite player, still is my favorite player. And I remember watching Mike Piazza, you know, hit a home run one day. I forget which game. I don't know where it was. And this is still something that bothers me. I wish I had the ticket or had the idea of what my first big league game was that I went to as a fan. I have no idea. There is a picture of me sitting in the orange seats at Shea Stadium with a Mike Piazza jersey on. I must have been, I don't know, 5 years old, 6 years old maybe, and I'm kind of turning around over my shoulder and you can see the Piazza on my back. And if I do say so myself, it's a pretty cute picture. But I remember going to Shea Stadium. I remember getting ice cream and a helmet cup. The helmet cup had the Mets logo on it. And still to this day, you know, getting ice cream and a helmet cup is such a transportive thing for me back to, you know, my childhood days as a baseball fan. That was always such a highlight for me, was going to the ballpark and around the seventh inning getting, you know, a twist in a cup with some chocolate sprinkles or whatever, and then keeping the helmet to bring home. So my origin as a Mets fan, I guess, is less related to actual baseball and more just related to ice cream. And I think that's okay too, right?
Very typical of the baseball fan experience, I think, for sure. Well, you remember the ambiance. You don't necessarily remember what game. I think the first game I remember going to was also kind of Mike Piazza related. It was, I believe, his last home game with the Mets in 2005, I think. And it's also funny, too. Like, I feel like a lot of Mets fans of our kind of generation, because you're a couple years older than us, but we're all kind of around the same age. I feel like 2006 was such a seminal year for, like, Mets fans in their, you know, of any age, but kind of in their, like, early to mid 20s, because that was like such, you know, we were kind of a little bit too young to fully appreciate the Subway Series in 2000, but like 2006, we were all kind of right there. Like, that was a big year for me, I know for Jake as well. So that definitely makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, 06 was right in the wheelhouse. And that's true. I think we all connect to baseball with the atmosphere that a ballpark brings. And we all have some of those memories of the sounds and the sights and the smells if we can't remember the exact plays or who pitched that day. And some people have that recall, and frankly, it's something that I'm jealous of. I wish I could do it too. But just connecting back to those days at Shea, growing up, you know, wearing the Mets gear on the train or in the car and walking through the gates and up those, you know, concrete ramps and seeing the neon signs on the outside when you leave the ballpark, yeah, those are really special memories.
People are always saying how, you know, like Shea Stadium is a dump, and Mets fans will say, yeah, well, it was our dump. But if you think about it, like, just the nostalgia kind of – I mean, I love Citi Field, but it obviously, like, doesn't have that same feel. And the Mets really haven't – I mean, obviously going to the World Series in 15, but it's not like they've had a ton of success so far in the stadium. So I feel like, I don't know, just Shea – when you think back at Shea Stadium, like, it just brings me back, and I'm sure you the same, like, back to your childhood, you know, and kind of, like, just how it felt to be a little kid and be a fan. But 2006, I mean, that was such a tease, because think about it. In 07, they collapsed. 08, they collapsed. And then after that, they just weren't really any good. So that's kind of a rough time to kind of be latching on. And what? How old did you – you said you were 11 back then?
I was 11. Here's what I'll say about Shea, because I think this is kind of interesting. And this dawned on me recently, is that, you know, we've grown up as Mets fans in some ways as a bridge between two different eras of this franchise. The franchise – that played at Shea Stadium and the franchise that now plays at Citi Field. And that's somewhat of a rare thing, I think, especially for young Mets fans who never experienced Shea Stadium. And yeah, there's the adage that Shea Stadium was a dump and it's our dump. But the truth is, as a kid, I'd never been to any other ballpark. I had no idea what else existed. To me, Shea Stadium was the most magical place in the world. I had no context for what the inside looked like compared to another ballpark. To me, yeah, every ballpark probably looked like that. And Shea Stadium was the best of all of them because that's where the Mets played. And then when Citi Field opened, it was this gorgeous new place. And again, that's nothing against Shea, but I think Citi Field has become a really, really great home for the New York Mets. And you've got, you know, the crowds that go out there, the black jerseys on Friday, the atmosphere there is electric. You know, you've got the Seven Line Army doing some great things with outings to away ballparks and also that section in center field. And, you know, remember some of those pictures from the 2015 World Series where it's just that sea of orange out there in center field. And I was at some of those World Series games in 2015. And I remember just thinking about how unique it was to be able to go to a World Series game, which is not something everyone gets to do, and trying to soak in the entire environment and the electricity that was in the ballpark those couple of nights at Citi. Even if the results weren't great, the experience was unforgettable.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned, like, kind of the aura that Shea has. I still feel like, you know, Citi Field is obviously beautiful, but I still feel like when you see, you know, because sometimes on Twitter you see, like, those overhead shots of Shea that circulate when, like, the New York skyline, and then just it was so colorful. And I feel like that really just translates into kind of an extra added experience. And with, like, the neon signs that I know, like, some people are trying to bring back in some form at Citi Field, which I think would be great, you know, continuing to honor Mets kind of iconography is, I think, a great thing, because they have a lot of kind of very well-known images that didn't necessarily make it into, like, the first edition of Citi Field. So yeah, definitely have very fond memories of Shea. That you're right, it's like people our age are kind of maybe some of not the last fans to, like, the youngest fans who, like, remember Shea Stadium, but you're right, it's, I do have kind of very distinct eras of fandom. It's almost like, okay, like, Shea Stadium era was like me as, like, a little kid, and then the Citi Field era was me as, like, becoming a teenager, and, like, just very different eras of kind of, you know, becoming, you know, even more into the Mets. And you mentioned when you were going, like, when you were talking earlier about, you know, taking the train to some games. And as I mentioned earlier in the kind of intro, we're both from the same town, and we're both from Port Washington, which, as people who take the Long Island Railroad know, is the best way to get to Mets games, because you hop on and it's like 25 minutes. Sometimes it's the express, so you're there in like 20 minutes and then you're like right at Citi Field. And I have to confess, it's kind of funny. So you were 2 years ahead of me in school, and I know we didn't really like know each other in school at all, but I remember I came across you on Twitter a little while ago, and just in kind of my baseball searchings, and I was like, wait a second, I feel like this person like looks familiar, and also like the name sounds very familiar. And then I remembered you specifically, and I don't know like how many memories you have of this, but when we were in middle school, we were both in a production of The Music Man, which I'm sure you remember, which was my first musical ever. And you were Harold Hill, which is the lead. For anyone who doesn't know Broadway, who's listening to this, which might be a lot of people, Harold Hill's like the lead in The Music Man. And I just remember thinking, like, I'm glad you pursued your baseball career, but I remember as like a sixth grader being like, wow, this guy was like so good. And then like, you, unfortunately, I know you didn't really do theater in high school, so it's fine. But I do want to congratulate you retroactively on a great performance in Weber Middle School's production of The Music Man.
Oh, thank you. Should I take a bow? No, that was a lot of fun. I did some shows in middle school. Did a couple of shows in high school. I think freshman year was Guys and Dolls, and sophomore year was, in retrospect, just an awful show called Curtains that I never want any part of again.
It's not that bad. But, I saw both of those.
That one was a rough one, but yeah, The Music Man, that was a lot of fun, and Harold Hill was a fun role, and I had a bunch of friends in middle school and high school that were involved in, you know, musical theater and did the shows and things like that, so that was a good time for all of us, and yeah, being The Music Man and, you know, doing the whole 76 trombones thing, that was a good time. There's still some pictures floating around that my friends will bring up every now and again of, you know, me holding the Professor Harold Hill briefcase and dressed in this oversized, I want to say it was like a blue and white striped suit that was clearly too big for me because I was not the tallest or biggest person back then. You know, pretty much everybody was taller than me in eighth grade. And so I was this somewhat diminutive Professor Harold Hill. And there's a bunch of pictures of me just looking like an absolute child on the stage at Weber Middle School. But yeah, that was a fun show.
Yeah, I feel like that's a lot the case for a lot of middle school shows where the costumes are like four sizes too big. Like, I remember we did a production, the show the next year when you were in high school was 13. And I remember not to get like way away from baseball, but there was a scene with like guys wearing football uniforms. And I just remember the football uniforms were like so huge. And then the guys in the show that had to wear them were like swimming in them. And it was just like a very amusing sight. So, but yeah, well, I know obviously you didn't pursue a career in theater, but I'm glad that we had at least those early memories of being in The Music Man. And it's funny, is it like the distance between a sixth grader and an eighth grader, I feel like is not that big in like the real world in terms of a 2-year age difference, but as like someone doing your first show and then it's like the eighth graders seem like Broadway stars, you know what I mean? It's like, wow, oh my God. It's the same thing with like freshmen in high school and like the seniors in the show. It's like, they must be like professional actors. It seems like a huge gulf. So
I think you can extrapolate that to, you know, a rookie on a baseball team looking up to the veteran on a team. Like, think about a guy who made his big league debut on the mound this year. Think of like Colin Holdman, for example, you know, being in the same clubhouse as Max Scherzer. You know, I'm not saying it's the same dynamic as a sixth grader and an eighth grader or a freshman and a senior, but you still have somebody who's brand new to a space and learning about being in that space and getting confident in that space around someone who has been there and done it better than anyone really ever has before. And I think those dynamics are kind of similar. And there's some similarities too, I think, between performing in a Broadway musical in middle school or high school and, you know, starting a career in broadcasting, because ultimately it all dials back to performance. This is a performance that we're putting on. This is entertainment. And I mean, the biggest difference is that for a Broadway show or musical theater, you're learning lines and you're practicing dances and routines and steps, and it's rehearsed. The difference between that and calling a baseball game is that you have no idea what's going to happen as soon as that first pitch is thrown. It's all extemporaneous. It's all off the cuff. It's all unscripted. But the art of performance is still there. And so I think, yeah, there may be some similarities there that one thing can lead to another. So there's our tie back together. There's our tie to baseball.
I've always kind of felt a connection between theater and baseball that, like, I don't know if like everyone sees, but just because I like love theater so much, it's always been something where you're kind of seeing things unfold. But you're right, obviously in baseball, you don't know how it's going to end. And that's part of the fun.
Exactly.
So can you kind of take us through how you transitioned from this great acting career into
semi-professional
into baseball broadcasting?
I would not call it a great acting career. Let's just call it an acting career and let other people use adjectives for it. Well, at Schreiber High School, there was also the student radio station there. You might remember WDOT. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy Claff, Mr. Claff, who taught social studies, also taught the radio class. And he had some experience in radio prior to teaching. He had done some stuff with the Binghamton Mets way back when, the Brooklyn Cyclones in days past. And so he taught the radio class at Schreiber High School. And I took Radio 1 and then Radio 2. And part of that was also having a show on WDOT. It was like this 30-minute talk show during lunch or whatever off period you had during the day. And so that was the first time that I had the chance to be on air, was in high school, you know, on the third floor of Schreiber High School, right around those right around the corner from the Commons, if you remember where
the
that
Commons.
Was. Elizabeth, yeah, exactly.
Yes, I do.
Jake has no idea what we're talking about,
I'm
but
sorry,
that's okay.
Jake.
That's okay. And so I had a 30-minute talk show with, you know, some of my best friends, you know, once a week, once every couple of weeks if our schedules got a little bit crazy. And so that was my first taste of being on the air and doing radio. And WDOT also did a little bit of play-by-play back then. I think they're doing a little bit more now. But I remember calling one quarter of one basketball game with a cassette tape recorder and a headset that you might imagine like a telemarketer would use. So it had like basically one earpiece and then the microphone came out in front and then the other side was just kind of empty. It was like the, you know, before Bluetooth, this is what people wore to talk on the phone hands-free. And it was awesome. It was an amazing experience to do play-by-play. And I didn't know a thing. I barely even knew the players' names. And I'm not just talking about the other team. I'm talking about the players that were on our team too. I don't even remember who they were, but like I'm like looking at the roster and seeing like whose numbers matches up to which people, and like I saw them in the hallway, but I didn't know what their names were. And so I was completely unprepared, knew nothing, but it was still a blast. And then when I got to college, I decided to join the student radio station there, WMUC Sports. And through that, I got a lot more experience, both doing a talk show, which was kind of just a fun thing to do with my roommate, but then also doing a lot of play-by-play. It started with women's basketball, got a chance to do a couple of men's basketball games. Then it was softball, and then it was field hockey, and then it became more men's basketball and some football, and ultimately baseball as a sophomore, and started doing a lot of, you know, baseball with the Maryland baseball team and creating the Maryland Baseball Network. And that's really when, you know, this bug bit me the most. And so I basically, you know, started doing Maryland baseball. That was my spring semester class, was the Maryland baseball schedule, especially as a junior and a senior, doing as many games as I could, home and away, traveling with the team, ultimately going to the Cape Cod League for a summer up there with the Chatham Anglers and gaining more experience of doing baseball every single day in the Cape Cod League and bringing that back to Maryland, and then ultimately starting in minor league baseball and kind of learning something new every day, trying to get a little bit better every day and then a little bit better every season. And here we are.
I guess I'm wondering, like, so you got into, like, what do you like best about broadcasting? Like, what is there one thing about it that specifically kind of drew you in? I know you mentioned kind of the live performance aspect, but is there kind of one aspect of, because you've done a lot of different broadcasting gigs, which I'm sure there are differences, and we can talk about those in a little, between like minor league broadcasting and also, you know, major league broadcasting. But like, is there one thing about it that just like is kind of one of the main joys of the job?
Oh, sure. At least for me, and I'm sure you could ask other broadcasters and they'll tell you a bunch of other different things. But for me, one of the most fun things about this job is, I'll call it the linguistic challenge of it. Because as a radio broadcaster, it's our job to describe everything that we see. Because the people that are listening, well, they can't see it. They're not watching it. They have no idea what's going on unless we tell them. And it's up to us to do that clearly and creatively and also very, very descriptively. We have to describe the colors of the uniforms like you hear Wayne talk about all the time. We have to describe where the defense is playing. We have to describe how the ball leaves the bat. You know, the verbs that we use when the ball's hit, those may sound random, but there is a difference between a ball that's, you know, crushed and a ball that's dribbled. There's a difference between a fastball that sears the outside corner or a curveball that drops in for a strike. And using those words and figuring out what the best order of those words is to paint that word picture for people, you know, trying to visualize and imagine what we're seeing, that's part of the most fun parts of it for me, and building that world, because we're building it from the ground up. It's a completely blank slate, and we have the opportunity to share it with everybody in a way that nobody else does. And so for me, the creativity aspect of trying to find the right words and right things to pick up on to help make that picture a little bit more solid in somebody's mind, and help them experience the ballpark despite not being there and not seeing it, that's probably the most fun aspect of what we do for me. And then there's also, of course, you know, the big moments when, you know, the team's down by a run and there's a runner on first and it's the bottom of the ninth and guy hits a walk-off homer and you just hear the crowd roar and it almost carries you. It's like, you know, to go back to, I guess, somewhat of a musical theater analogy, it's like the carpet in Aladdin just like picking you up and you're riding that carpet across the sky, and that carpet is the jubilation and the roar of the crowd, and it just carries you through the rest of the broadcast. So yeah, those are, I'd say, the two most special things about what we do. But yeah, the description, the creativity, and the joy of hearing that crowd roar and building upon it, it's unlike anything else.
I mean, I obviously have an appreciation for what Gary and all the TV announcers do, but I just feel like radio is so different because you really are the listener's eyes, like, obviously, and you have to really be descriptive in what you're saying. It's not just like on TV where they can basically describe it because everybody can see what's going on. So do you appreciate that? Like, if you were doing TV, say, would you prefer to do radio because how descriptive you have to be and how much of a story you really have to tell?
Oh, they're completely different from a broadcaster's perspective. And is simply put, you can think about it like this. On the radio, you're painting the picture. There is no picture in front of them. It is a completely blank canvas. You're painting the picture. On TV, you're providing the captions to that picture. And so there's an opportunity to talk through a pitch here or there. You don't have to say nearly as many words. For a grounder to short, you can just say, grounder to short, Lindor to first, and that's it. That's all anyone needs to know because they can see it. But if you're on the radio, you have to say, grounded softly to the left side, Lindor two steps to his right, scoops it up into his chest, steps, fires to first. You have to be just a little bit more descriptive with it. And so those are the two big differences. But make no mistake, they are both art forms and both incredibly challenging in their own right. I haven't had a chance to do a ton of baseball games on TV or on the digital side, but when I have, the biggest challenge, honestly, is pulling back and trying to be less descriptive and understanding that I don't have to say everything that I see because people can see it. And that's a really hard thing to do, especially after you've done radio for so long. And so for Gary, especially, to be able to do the job he does on TV with the radio background that he has, I mean, he's the best of the best for a reason. And he really is the best of the best.
Yeah, and I've also been really impressed, too. And we can get into kind of your Mets broadcasting experience as well. Just seeing Wayne do mostly radio, but also he's done a few TV broadcasts here and there this year. And he's done a fantastic job, I think. Just like on the Apple TV broadcast, for example, I think it was Mets against the Angels. He did that game. And I was like, because, you know, the Apple TV, the national games, it's not the same kind of personal feel when you're watching as a fan because the announcers don't know your team as well. But I've been really impressed just seeing him do, you know, a mix, mostly radio, like I said, but also filling in on TV here and there. And you're right. It does, you know, I guess we don't, as fans watching, realize just maybe the difference. Yeah. In the approach, like you're almost like a hitter's approach at the plate. It's like kind of a different approach in, you know, the radio booth versus the TV booth. And yeah, so let's get into kind of your Mets experience this year. So I know I saw you on the Orange and Blue Thing podcast recently, where you were talking about kind of how you got the Mets job. So I don't necessarily want you to rehash that entire story, but I'm just kind of wondering, like, what, like, do you feel at all kind of more settled in to this role? And also, like, kind of what are like the most prominent emotions maybe you felt when you like heard the news, and also even now just like doing a Mets game, as like you said, growing up a Mets fan, and you've gotten your feet wet, obviously, but it's still your rookie season as a Mets broadcaster.
There's still a good amount of shock and awe that's involved every time you sit down in a major league broadcast booth and put the headset on and the mic's hot and you start talking and it's you. You know, after growing up listening to the people tell you about the Mets games your entire life, now all of a sudden it's my job to do that. And that's still a really awesome responsibility. And yeah, I would say that there's still some aspect of it that is incredibly daunting because the responsibility is so great. And I do feel as though over the course of the last couple of months that I've settled in a little bit. There's a little bit less newness to it, and there's a little bit more understanding of how the flow of the day is going to go, you know, how the broadcast is going to operate. And at the end of the day, you know, one of the best pieces of advice that I've gotten that was hard to take initially was, it's still a baseball game. It's still the same game that I've been calling at the minor league level for the last 5 years. Sure, you know, there's some differences here and there, like the minor league has a pitch clock now, the big leagues doesn't. There's some differences in just the style of the game and the style of the broadcast. Like at the minor league level, it's partially my job to introduce all of these players to everybody listening for the first time. Nobody really knows a ton about them. But at the big league level, like, people know about Pete Alonso. People know about Jacob DeGrom. People know about Francisco Lindor. We're not diving into their biographies as much as we would be if they were still in minor league baseball and up-and-coming players. So that's one, you know, major difference just in the broadcast style. And so, I think this is a roundabout way of answering your question is, yeah, there's this weird out-of-body experience that still happens over the course of a couple of games. I think it, remember the last time it happened was at Dodger Stadium back at the beginning of June. And we're sitting there, it's like the fifth inning, and I just tossed it back to Wayne for the play-by-play, and I kind of leaned back in my chair a little bit, looked around, and it was kind of this feeling of, whoa, we're calling a game at Dodger Stadium, and it's a Mets game, and I'm here. Not watching it, not listening to it, not sitting in the stands, I'm here talking about it and delivering it. And there's still, like I said, that weird out-of-body experience that's almost like this incredible trance of awareness that this is what we're doing, and suddenly I'm in this position. So I think, yeah, there's a bit of a balance there between still almost some disbelief about the opportunity that I have, and also, yeah, getting a little bit more comfortable in actually doing it.
Yeah, and you talked about kind of how you got to do that at Dodger Stadium. Like, I feel like, obviously, I guess it's a little more historical than Shea Stadium was, but it's in the same realm, you know, how just it's been around forever. And that's got to be incredible, that your first season announcing the Mets, and that you get to do it in Dodger Stadium, your favorite team. Like, I can't imagine the emotions that you've got to be going through doing something like that. And the fact that you're kind of able to enjoy that in the moment, I feel like not everybody would kind of realize that. But that's pretty special as well, I think.
Yeah, I think it's important to take a deep breath or two and kind of sit back and soak in the atmosphere of where we are and what we're doing. And I've tried to do that in all the places we've gone, whether it was, you know, Chase Field at the beginning of this season where, you know, my first game was, or Busch Stadium in St. Louis, Coors Field, Oracle Park, Dodger Stadium, Petco Park, Angel Stadium. You know, I've had the chance to go to some pretty cool places that I'd never been to before. And so, you know, I've been trying to get to the ballpark a little bit earlier on at least one of the days of this year so I can really go walk around and explore the ballpark and see some of the nooks and crannies of the things that they have hanging up at Dodger Stadium. They've got pictures everywhere. The names of the section at Angel Stadium. They've got this section out in left field corner called the Trout Farm. Checking out the Western Metal Supply Company building in Petco Park. I mean, these are just a few of the things from, you know, the last road trip. You know, I remember going over to look at the slides at Oracle Park that are in the Coke bottle and learning that there's two slides, not just one. I didn't know that before. And getting to see that big baseball glove up close. I mean, these are some of the iconic landmarks of ballparks in the game right now. And so getting to see those up close and, you know, call games there, it was pretty special. And then, you know, having the chance to call a doubleheader with Howie Rose at Citi Field at the home ballpark in mid-May, that is something that I'll never forget. That was really, really special.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, actually, because obviously as a lifelong Mets fan, you've been listening to Howie Rose probably your whole life. So that must have been pretty surreal. Obviously, it's still a job and you need to treat it professionally. I understand that. But I'm sure it still had to be going through your head that, like, wow, I'm sitting next to Howie Rose calling this game right now. Like, that's got to be pretty incredible.
Yeah, and in all honesty, Jake, it was a pretty surreal 36 hours because I had gotten the phone call from WCBS that they were wondering if I was available to fill in that day. I got that phone call about 24 hours before first pitch for that doubleheader on Tuesday. And I was in Omaha. I had just gotten back from Des Moines, Iowa, where the Storm Chasers had played a week-long series. It was an off day. It was a Monday. And we were about to start a home series at Warner Park. And so I get this phone call. And it's like, hey, we've got a scheduling issue. There's a doubleheader now, and Wayne's going to fill in on the TV side. Can you get to New York and come fill in on the radio side? And I'm thinking, I'm gonna fill in and be on the air with Howie Rose at Citi Field. I'm going to figure out how to get to New York. And the saga began from there because there were no flights out of Omaha that would get me to New York in time for first pitch on Tuesday. And so I wound up booking a flight out of, ironically, Des Moines for Tuesday morning, first thing. Des Moines is about 2 hours from Omaha. It's a straight shot across I-80, you literally can't get lost because there's only one road. To your left, you see a bunch of wind turbines. To your right, you see a bunch of cows and corn. There's literally nowhere to turn. It's just a straight drive. It's a very pleasant drive, actually. I've done it a number of times now over the course of the last couple of years. So wound up waking up at like 3:30 in the morning in Omaha on Tuesday, driving to the airport in Des Moines, got there about 5:45 for a 7 a.m. flight. You can fly through security in Des Moines and Omaha, too. It's not like LaGuardia or JFK.
Where you have to and, get 3 hours early.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Flight. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't need to do that with some of these smaller airports. But I get to the airport and I check my bag and lo and behold, my flight's delayed. And I'm starting to think, oh my goodness, is this flight going to take off? Am I going to get there in time? You know, what can I do? And you're just kind of stuck. And so a 7 a.m. flight became a 9 a.m. flight. A 10:45 arrival became a 12:45 arrival. And I didn't actually get to the ballpark until about 1:30, 1:45 for a 3:10 first pitch, which is later than I think I've gotten to a ballpark for a game in my entire life. And, of course, this is a game that's going to be a doubleheader. So it's not just one game, it's two. And, of course, it's next to Howie Rose, and it's at Citi Field, and it is the dream of dreams come true. And, you know, like, here I am scrambling to get ready. I filled out the lineups on the plane. I had somebody text me the lineups. So I had my scorebook open on that little table, just, like, scribbling down the names and the lineup, one less thing to do. And it was a doubleheader that I will never forget. And I think part of it was good that it took so long to get there, and it was such a whirlwind, because I didn't have any time to really think about it. I didn't have any time to be nervous or get in my own head. It was like I got there and we had to go. And we talked about kind of those out-of-body experiences, those out-of-body moments. And the one that stands out to me the most from that day is the end of game one, Mets win. Howie says, put it in the books. And I'm sitting there to his right, like looking at him as he's saying and exclaiming, put it in the books. And that was like a whoa moment. Like, how many times have I heard that on the radio, wherever I am listening? How many times have I seen a video of him doing that? I mean, I've had the chance to observe him in the booth a couple of times, so I've been there to witness it before, but never inside of the moment, if that makes sense. And that's something that was just, that was a pinch me moment of all pinch me moments, was just watching him, the iconic him, do his iconic thing.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like, I was like, I read the book called Put It in the Books. And like now
right,
you're
exactly, exactly.
And now like it's being said, it's almost like you're inside a movie hearing like, or like hearing an actor kind of say a famous line from a movie, or like, it's like,
that's it. That's it right there. That's exactly the feeling. And it's like, oh, this is a real thing that happens in life. And now I somehow am a small part of this story that I've read my entire life. It was like you said, Jake, it was surreal.
That's fantastic. And you know, I'm kind of wondering, so you worked with Howie on that doubleheader, but I'm kind of wondering, like, you know, on a day-to-day, because you know Mets fans get really attached to their announcers, as you know, as I'm sure you are as well. So what has it kind of been like getting to know him a little bit better, but also getting to know Wayne a little better? And I know you mentioned that you worked with a couple of other broadcasters on the big league side as well, working with Ed Coleman and also Mike Sweeney for the Royals. So what's it kind of been like getting to know some of these, you know, you've worked in broadcasting for a few years, but kind of getting to know some of these, you know, big league broadcasters and seeing kind of how they go about their business.
It's interesting. And everybody's style is very different. And I think that's what makes some of this a lot of fun is learning about these people, not just as broadcasters, but as people, and bringing that relationship on the air to the best of our ability. And one of the things that was probably the most daunting about this opportunity for me is the idea of calling a game with somebody else, which is somewhat rare at the minor league level. There's not always a second voice on the air like there is the major league side. And until this year, I hadn't called a baseball game with another person since 2019, since I was in Richmond with the Flying Squirrels, and Trey Wilson was the lead broadcaster there, and he and I would call games together. So it had been a while since, you know, there was another voice next to me that I had to address or think about or, you know, consider, you know, working into the broadcast in some way, and vice versa. You know, I hadn't been in a role where I wasn't doing play-by-play and I was giving context or analysis. That was new for me, or at least, you know, new for the first time in 3 years. And they're all very different. I think one thing that sets Howie apart is just how much knowledge he has. he just knows everything. And, you know, when you've been a Mets fan since day one, like, of course you know everything. But, you know, something will happen on the field and it'll just spark something in his brain of a game from, like, the 1970s where this guy did that. And he can just connect the two so seamlessly and bridge the gap between young Mets fans and Mets fans of a different generation, because Howie is of that older generation now. And it's his ability to do that so naturally that sets him apart. And then obviously, you know, the natural joy that he has in calling those big Mets moments, the pride that he has in calling those big Mets moments for Mets fans, of which he is one. And so calling a game sitting next to Howie Rose was almost like the most interesting history lesson you could ever have in your life. And really just talking to him in general is kind of like that, because he can pull some of those things that you've never even heard of or thought about or whatnot. You know, Wayne does an incredible job of finding context in what's happening, not just within the game that the Mets are playing, but around the league, because he reads so much and he sees so much and he retains so much. That's the biggest thing that impresses me about Wayne. And I've asked him about this because, you know, I saw him a few weeks ago, or I guess it was now about a month ago. Time doesn't matter. Anyway, I saw him a while back having a conversation down on the field during batting practice with Eric Chavez, the Mets hitting coach. And they were just casually chatting. And, you know, I was, you know, a little bit further away, you know, kind of doing my own thing. And we get back up to the booth and we didn't really talk about it at all. But then, like, 2 days later, something happens in the game and he starts talking about this conversation that he had with Eric Chavez as if it had happened 5 minutes ago. And I'm looking over there, like, watching him do this thing, and I'm trying to see, like, does he have this down on paper anywhere? Is there, like, you know, did he type something in, like, the notes section of his app? Is it on his computer? Exactly. And there's nothing there. It's just his scorebook. And I'm, like, slack-jawed trying to think about how he was able to retain this with everything that swirls around the team on a daily basis, because there is so much information. And so I asked him after the game, I was like, how did you do that? And he just said that, you know, over time you build kind of a memory muscle that allows you to retain those conversations more specifically. And it's something he said that he's always really been able to do memory-wise. But he just retains so much information and can regurgitate it in such a conversational way. That's something that sets him apart. With Ed Coleman, getting a chance to do games with him was so much fun. I think if you were listening, I hope you'd never known that we'd only met for the first time like 4 hours before first pitch. You know, it was like I'd known him for 10 years. And so we were just having a good time. We were talking about his flight getting in. We were talking about the Angel City Connect jerseys, just like really riffing with each other. And Ed has such a comedic mind and really good comedic timing that he's a lot of fun to play with on the air, going back and forth and just kind of picking up on something he says and turning it into something funny or jovial and vice versa. And he also, like Howie, has a wealth of Mets knowledge and a wealth of relationships with players that he can dig into at a moment's notice. So, you know, working with the three of them, it's a very different experience all the way around, but it's also a very fun experience no matter what. And then, you know, quickly on Mike Sweeney, I had the chance to fill in on a couple of Royals games back in May and call the games with Mike Sweeney. And that's completely different from the other three because Mike is a former player. He was down on the field. He did it. He knows exactly what he's talking about. And so he, unlike Howie, Wayne, or Ed, is a true analyst of what's happening down on the field. And so leaning into that with him on the air is really important. It was also the first time he'd ever done anything like that at that time. And he was a natural. He understood the timing of the radio broadcast really well. He was engaging. He was enthusiastic. He had great stories to share. And one of the more fun things that we got the chance to do, or that I had the chance to do, is almost, you know, coach him a little bit in some ways as we were going on. You know, we would talk between innings and he'd bring up this story and I'd be like, Mike, hold that thought. That's amazing. Like, we need to bring this up on the air. And so I would kind of lead him in that direction. Like, there was this great story he told. I'll tell you a quick story here. So at Kansas City, Kauffman Stadium, they have the fountains. And every now and again, a home run lands in the fountains. And it was MJ Melendez's major league debut that night. Bobby Witt Jr. Hadn't yet hit a big league home run. He wound up hitting his first that night. And Mike and I got to talking. I was like, kind of jokingly, so what happens if like a first big league homer lands in the fountains? Like, is somebody going fishing for it? Is someone diving in to get that baseball so the player has a memento? And without hesitation, Mike tells this story about a former Kansas City Royal, Aaron Guile, who hit his first big league homer into the fountains at Kauffman Stadium. And post game, Mike Sweeney's in the clubhouse. He's in the trainer's room, and he tells the trainer to go get Aaron Guile. And while the trainer is going to get Aaron, Sweeney takes a baseball, tosses it in the hot tub in the trainer's room. And then he gets in the hot tub himself. And he's there for like 3 minutes. He gets out of the hot tub. He's sopping wet. He's got this wet, soggy baseball. Aaron Guile comes into the trainer's room, and Mike's like, Aaron, I got your first home run ball. Had to get it for you. Had to get it out of the fountains. Here you go, man. Congratulations. And basically, Aaron totally bought it. The trainer played along. The trainer was like, Mike, what are you doing? You can't go swimming in the fountains. And Mike's like, no, I had to go get it for Aaron. This is a special thing. And Aaron couldn't have been more appreciative. And as Mike was saying on the air that night, to that day, Aaron still believed that that was the home run ball that he put the mantle at his mom's house in Canada. And Mike had never told that story publicly before. And so now we're sitting there cracking up, wondering if Aaron's listening, thinking, so you're telling me this ball that I've had on this mantle this whole time was just some random baseball chucked in a hot tub? Anyway, the point is, it's stories like that that you can draw out of a person like that, and their willingness to engage and share those stories is what really enriches a broadcast. And getting the chance to work with all these different people who have such different experiences and backgrounds and focuses has been a blast.
So obviously, though, with doing the Royals, some major league, a lot of AAA, and doing stuff for the Mets, like, there's a lot you got to keep in your mind and a lot you got to remember now. I mean, it's a lot already with one team. Now you're balancing basically three, if you think about it. So I just want to know, like, what's that challenge been like, kind of trying to remember everything and keeping your everything in order? Like, has that been hard for you?
When I figure it out, I'll let you know, because it's still kind of an in-progress thing every day of making sure that, yeah, I'm on top of what's happening with the Omaha Storm Chasers and, you know, by proxy, the Kansas City Royals, because what happens with the Royals on a daily basis affects what happens with the Storm Chasers. If they have a long ball game and they use six relievers, somebody here might be getting called up. Vinny Pasquantino made his big league debut the other day. So how does that affect what's going on with the Storm Chasers and all that? So now we're paying attention when Vinny's going to get his first hit and things like that. So what happens with the Storm Chasers and the Royals is very interconnected. And also, obviously, what's going on with the Mets? I got to know exactly what's happening. And sure, I've followed along over the last couple of years as a fan, somewhat loosely. But now, as someone who's charged with delivering these games to people, I have to be as much, if not more, of an authority on what's happening with the Mets and their players as anybody else. And I think one of the biggest challenges is that I can't really watch the games or listen to the games live because I've got games going on with the Omaha Storm Chasers. If I'm not calling the Mets game, I'm calling an Omaha Storm Chasers game. And more often than not, they're at the same times. You know, with rare exceptions where one team has a day game and the other team doesn't, it's hard for me to actually watch the games live. And so, you know, I do my best to try and watch a replay of it or listen to a replay of it if I can while I'm in transit somewhere, which is still not really the same thing. You try and read as much as you can from, you know, the various beat writers, and you see the highlights and you kind of follow it on social media and things like that. But I would say that that's absolutely been the biggest challenge this year, is keeping all of the information straight and staying on top of all of the information for basically three different teams in three different leagues over the course of the last couple of months. That's certainly been tough.
That's true, because like the Royals are in the AL, so it's not even like they don't play the Mets. So there's kind of no, like, you doing a Mets game, you'd kind of wouldn't really learn anything that would pertain whatsoever to the Royals, and like vice versa. So because just their lives don't really interact unless they play once every like 4 years. Yeah, no, Jake and I were talking about this before the podcast, and we were like, how there's a lot going on.
Yeah,
to,
I don't
like,
know. The one ironic thing is, so the Mets played the Cardinals at Busch Stadium in late April, which is my first, you know, Mets trip. And then about 2 weeks after that is when I wound up filling in those couple of games for the Royals. And sure enough, they were playing the Cardinals just by coincidence. And then 2 weeks after that, when this whirlwind doubleheader happened at Citi Field, guess what? They were playing the Cardinals. And so there was a certain point where I had seen more Cardinals baseball than I had any other big league team, just by sheer coincidence. And so that was helpful a little bit, because I'd already done, you know, a good amount of research and stuff on the Cardinals. But yeah, in general, it's really, really hard because of how many players there are and how many moving parts there are. I mean, especially at the AAA level when rosters are so fluid and players are coming and going so often. I mean, there's a new player on the Storm Chasers that made his debut yesterday. And so you've got to spend time learning about him and trying to talk to him and getting to know him so that you can share his story with the Storm Chasers fan base and the Royals fan base, because he's new to the organization too. And so balancing all of that while also balancing making sure that you're on top of what's going on at Citi Field, yeah, it's a challenge. It's one that hopefully I've done a decent job of so far, that I've tried to figure out the best ways to do it, the most efficient ways to do it. But there are certainly, unfortunately, going to be things here and there, both on the Mets side and on the Storm Chasers side, that I simply just don't know because I wasn't there or don't have a memory of because I wasn't there. I mean, it happened the other day with the Storm Chasers. Nick Prado hit a first inning home run against the St. Paul Saints pitcher who had pitched against Omaha at Warner Park about a month and a half ago, a game that I was not there for because I was calling games for the Mets. And sure enough, in that game, Prado had hit a home run off the same pitcher. And after the fact, I realized, and that would have been a great thing to know going in, or a great thing to have realized going in. And unfortunately, it was something that I just missed that day. And that bothers me a lot. You can only do so much, but it's still going to bother me. But yeah, it's things like that, that every now and again, there's something that slips through the cracks because there are cracks, and just doing our best to plug them and be as prepared as possible. That's all we can really do.
And with all the minor league baseball you've been able to see, I'm sure you've seen a lot of top prospects play. And I'm just kind of curious, is there any player, I mean, obviously Bobby Witt and some players stand out, but is there any players that you kind of saw and knew they were a top prospect and were like, wow, like this guy's going to be pretty good?
Yeah, the answer is Bobby Witt Jr.
Yeah,
that guy's a superstar, and that goes for who he is off the field too. I mean, he is the most special player that I've been around at the minor league level, and it's not particularly close. There are others that come to mind that were also really, really good. Luis Robert was in Winston-Salem in 2018 when I was there. Dylan Cease was in Winston-Salem that season too. They're all obviously, you know, having great starts to their careers with the Chicago White Sox. There are some other players over the last couple of years that have come through the Storm Chasers, like MJ Melendez and Vinny Pasquantino, and I think Nick Prado is going to be a really special player at the big league level too. Jackson Coar and Brady Singer and Daniel Lynch and, you know, some of the Royals' young pitching as well. So there's been some, you know, high-profile prospects that have certainly gone on to shine the way that people have expected them to. But Bobby Witt Jr. is definitely at the top of that list.
Yeah, it's funny. Speaking of Bobby Witt Jr., I think one of the first times I kind of became aware of you, like as a broadcaster, is what I saw a clip of a call that you made of a catch that Bobby Witt Jr. made that kind of went, you know, circulated around the internet because he was a top prospect at the time. I think he was like running back, like into the left. I'm sure you remember what I'm talking about.
Exactly what you're talking about. We were talking about this yesterday here in St. Paul. Because Brewer Hicklin, who's an outfielder for the Storm Chasers, made an insane diving catch last night in left center field. One of the best catches, one of the best defensive plays this season. And I was talking to Brewer about it after the game. And, you know, we were wondering, like, is it going to get on SportsCenter? Did it happen too late? Maybe they'll pick it up. And I was telling him that last year the Storm Chasers had two plays on SportsCenter. One of them was this ridiculous play that Gabe Spier, a pitcher, made on the mound where he kind of knocked the ball and it went up in the air and then fell in his glove and he made the play at first. And the other was this Bobby Witt Jr. catch that you're talking about, Elizabeth, where he's playing shortstop. There's this little shallow flare into left field down the line, and Bobby sprints back toward the left field corner, full extension dive like Superman, and catches the ball. The situation was also pretty cool. It was second and third with two outs, so, you know, Bobby saved at least a run there too. It was Jose Quas's AAA debut. He's now at the big league level also, and a former Maryland Terrapin, so shout out to Jose. But yeah, that's the most ridiculous catch I think I've ever seen at the minor league level, and that play wound up number two on SportsCenter. And so we were talking about that catch just last night, and yeah, the way that it was with Bobby for the couple of months he was with the Storm Chasers last year, it was like every night there was something jaw-dropping that he was going to do that you'd never expect. Whether it was hit an inside the park home run, which he did twice, make a diving catch like that, you know, beat out a grounder to the right side for an infield hit. I mean, he was doing stuff like this night in and night out. So yeah, such an exciting player to watch, and seeing him shine at the big league level has been awesome.
Maybe I'm just like a sucker for like infielders catching balls in the outfield, because I still feel like, you know, the David Wright catch where he like dives barehand is like the greatest catch. I firmly maintain that's like the greatest catch I've ever seen. Like maybe one of the greatest catches ever.
Andy Chavez like, wants a word.
Yes, they're different. They're different, but just in terms of sheer improbability in terms of a bare hand diving catch, that David Wright catch is like my favorite ever. But I know the Bobby Witt Jr. play was a little bit different, but yeah, see, you never know. I guess that's one thing that's interesting about, like, you know, minor league baseball is, I guess the audience is not quite the same as it would be for like a major league team, but you never know who's why. I feel like that's important in any kind of field, you know, whether it's writing, like, or editing, or like broadcasting, like you're doing. You never know who's watching, you never know who's listening, and who it like make an impression on. Like, I saw that clip and I was like, wow, this was like a really enthusiastic, exciting call. And I wouldn't say I'm someone who's super aware overall of like minor league broadcasters, but that made an impression on me, but just because, and I remembered it. So you never know who's like watching. I guess, you know, that might be, maybe, I don't know if that's like another difference between, like, do you feel a conscious difference when you're broadcasting like a Mets game versus a minor league game, that you like are aware of more people, almost like you're performing in front of like a bigger audience? Like, does that kind of enter your mind while you're doing the game, that a lot more people might be listening?
You know, I thought it would. I really did, because the difference in audience is astronomical. But in truth, it's not something that was that really hit me in a way that changed what I did. Like, yeah, there's an understanding that, okay, there's a lot more people that are listening to these games other than family and friends and, you know, of players and people that I know, frankly. But the truth is, like you said, you never know who's listening. You never know how many people are listening. And the truth is that the minor league side, that number can be small sometimes, certainly depending on where you are, you know, and what level you're at. And the way that I've always tried to go about it is, as long as there's one person listening, then I have a job to do for that one person. I have to bring the game to them, whether it's one person or 100 people or 1,000 people or 10,000 people. You know, whatever the size of the audience, I've got to deliver that game and paint that picture for them. There is an awareness, I think, nowadays with social media that, you know, you see clips of these big plays, you know, all over the place. And there's an awareness from broadcasters, not just myself, but around minor league baseball, that, yeah, when there's a player on the field that has been getting a lot of attention or is billed as a top prospect, that, you know, something he does is probably going to go somewhere. And I'm not saying that that changes what you do either, but it's certainly something that you're aware of. So, yeah, as soon as Bobby makes that catch, you kind of know in the back of your head, okay, going to see that clip somewhere later. Hope it was a good call. And, you know, more often than not, I'd like to think that I've delivered, you know, in some way, shape, or form with things like that, whether on, you know, the Storm Chasers side or on the Mets side, because WCBS will share, you know, clips of those big moments also. But it's not necessarily about nailing the big moment. You've got to nail the entire game. The big moments are part of that, whether, again, it's an audience of 10,000 or 100,000 or just one.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, I'm sure what WCBS and the Mets, what they've heard from you before the season, that's kind of what they loved and why you're doing Mets games now, you know? So like, why change yourself and kind of what you're doing, you know, like if it got you here, don't mess it up. Don't change it. But I kind of just want to know. So obviously the Braves are getting a little closer in the standings than most Mets fans thought would happen this soon or would hope. So I'm kind of wondering you personally, your thoughts, what the panic level should be, if any, and your take so far kind of on the Mets season.
The panic level. Where's our panic level? Why is it always about the panic level?
Hey,
why
I've been putting this question off for weeks, but it's a 3.5 game lead now. So.
And I feel like we as Mets fans just love to panic. That's part of our nature as Mets fans. But I think if we shift our perspective a little bit, it might be really healthy for us. And so I shared this the other day on Twitter. I just looked at the Mets month-by-month record, and so I'll read this to you. April, the Mets went 15-7. In May, the Mets went 19-10. In June, the Mets went 13-12. By far, their worst month of the season in terms of a one-loss record, 13-12. And yet, the worst month of the season for the Mets, they won more times than they lost. They started the month in first place. They finished the month in first place. And they did that all without having Jacob deGrom or Max Scherzer for the entire month, and they haven't had deGrom the entire season. The point is, those two are coming back at some point, potentially, you know, within the next couple of weeks, right after the All-Star game. That's right, Elizabeth. Fingers crossed. We hope so. We hope to see them back on the mound and dominating very, very soon. And so my point here is that my point here is that if you are the New York Mets and your worst month is over 500 and a month that sees you maintain first place in the National League East and, oh, also enter the next month with the most wins in the National League, you're doing all right. You're doing all right 3 months into the year. And there's a reason why the baseball season is a marathon, not a sprint. And so the panic level for me is, sure, this could come back to bite me, but it's at an absolute zero. Deep breaths. There's still 3 full months of the baseball season left. We're not even at the All-Star break yet. There's still trades to be made and, you know, players that can get called up and players that can go on hot stretches and, you know, also the opposite side of that. There's a long, long baseball season. And so I try not to get too high or too low early on. Save that, save the stress, save the panic, save the anxiety, save that for September. That's when it's useful. I think in June, in July, let's just enjoy the summer. Enjoy a really good Mets team playing really good baseball over the summer at Citi Field. So let's just take a deep breath. Panic level for me is at zero.
All right, love to hear it.
I think part of that, too, is like even before the season started, Jake and I were like, the Braves are going to be a good team. I mean, I didn't think the Braves, even if I hoped the Mets would be good, I didn't really think at any point early on that the Mets would be 10 and a half games ahead of them, to be quite honest. Like, I didn't think the Braves, you know, they started off badly last year and then they got better, too. But, you know, if it's one of those things where, you know, perspective is everything. If you told me the Mets would be 3.5 games up on July 1st, I'd be like, yeah, like, let's go, you know. So it's
exactly. Exactly.
You know, I'd be like, if it's hard.
Heck,
you can't
remove
the context.
If you told me the Mets are going to be 3.5 games out of first place on July 1st, I probably would have said, all right, that's good. Striking distance.
Striking distance.
You know,
yeah,
so
exactly.
That perspective is very, very important. And yes, this team has very high aspirations. You know, it's don't want to say World Series or bust, but it's getting close to that aspect. It's certainly this team has to make the playoffs. There's no question about that. We saw, you know, once the postseason starts, it's a roll of the dice a lot. I mean, the Atlanta Braves won 88 games last year, entered the postseason, and then won the World Series. So the best team in the regular season doesn't always win the World Series. In fact, that's more often than not the case. And so the goal of the regular season, the goal for the Mets, is to put themselves in the best position to succeed come October. And part of that is just making sure that they're playing baseball in October, which right now they're doing a really, really good job of. So, again, I'll say, pump the brakes, enjoy the summer.
I agree. They have
a very healthy attitude.
Yeah, and I'm glad your panic level, that settled me down a little. I mean, I haven't been freaking out. It's just when you have a 10.5 game lead and then it's down to 3 at one point, it's a little startling. Like, I understand. I get it. Like, you're right. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And there's a lot of games left to be played, but I don't know. Just thinking kind of the circumstances a little, like, it's just a little nerve-wracking that we had this huge lead and it's as little as it is. And then who knows? We could honestly go on a tear right now, and in a couple weeks, this won't even matter, you know? It could go right back to where it was. You never
exactly.
know.
Exactly. And that's what we're talking about, Jake, with the shift in perspective, is that the Mets had a 10.5 game lead because they were so, so good in April and May. And because they had that cushion, they could withstand a June where they went, you know, one game over 500 while the Braves won, what, 10 in a row?
14
and the Phillies
in a
won
row.
9
the
in
Braves
a row.
Won
yeah,
for
whatever,
2 weeks.
Whatever it wound up, whatever it wound up being.
Yeah.
You know, it was ridiculous. And there, again, there's nothing saying that the Mets can't do that too and build up a big lead. There's nothing that says the Braves aren't going to lose 14 in a row at some point. We just saw that with the Angels, who went on that long losing streak. And so, yeah. The ebbs and flows of a baseball season are just that, ebbs and flows, and building that lead to be able to withstand one of those ebbs or flows, that's what it's all about. So, yeah, it's a marathon, and there's still, you know, 13.5 miles to go or something like that.
I think it's also hard, too, and, you know, you're aware of this, all the Mets broadcasters who are Mets fans are aware of this. It's like there's been so much more, like, disappointment than jubilation at the end of the season for Mets fans. It's like, I do feel like Mets fans are just conditioned to expect collapses and disaster, and because they've happened. And so I can understand the perspective of fans, like, you know, expecting things to go very poorly, but just because it has happened, you know. But I also think, you know, it's a completely different team than last year. It's a totally different, like, landscape of, I think, hope and just competence overall. And, you know, one of the things you were saying, which Jake and I have talked a lot about on our podcast, is like just the wealth of knowledge that, you know, Howie Rose brings just from years of experience. And, you know, I feel like, you know, the wealth of baseball knowledge and just leadership that like Buck Showalter has brought, for example, and even Max Scherzer, you know, even though he's only made 8 starts, just the amount of leadership that I feel like he's brought, it does give a completely different aura. Whereas last year, I didn't feel like the Mets had any level of that kind of leadership, especially from the manager level. So I do feel like, yes, they're in a great spot, but I also feel like they are built to withstand kind of obstacles a lot better now. And so they've lost 3 games in a row for the first time all year, and they're still in a good, you're right. It's like, let's just enjoy it and not, I do feel like also, you know, Mets
fans I think you really make a really good point here, in that this team is different than the teams of the past. You have a lot of new faces. Mark Canha is a new face. Starling Marte is a new face. Chris Bassitt is a new face. Max Scherzer is a new face. And these are all really important contributors on this current Mets team. And so what really are the connections to, say, this Mets team and the Mets from 2007 that collapsed, or 2008 that couldn't make the playoffs? And the answer is, well, they wear the same uniforms. That's it. And so, yeah, we have the collective trauma of those collapses, but I don't think that those should be any indication or have any impact on what this 2022 Mets team does. Just because they're the same franchise doesn't mean it's the same results. Sure, there's history involved and all that. But again, it's a different group of players led by, as you said, Elizabeth, a different manager who's got a ton of experience. And ultimately, look, there's only one team left when the season ends. There's only one fan base that is truly, truly happy. Only one. That's it. Out of 30. And there are some teams that overachieve and make the playoffs, and they're just happy to be there, like the Mariners last year. There are some teams that have World Series or bust expectations, like the Dodgers, who, you know, could win 8 division titles in 9 years and not be satisfied. I mean, think about some of the fan bases across Major League Baseball, how thrilled they would be to win 1 division title, let alone, you know, 8. And so that perspective is important too. And again, point being, this team's different. This team's really, really good. That doesn't mean they're going to win at all. It means they've got a good chance to do it. And we're just going to enjoy the ride.
All you can ask for is a chance. And I feel like we haven't had that in a long time. I mean, last year we had that feel like halfway into the summer, but I feel like there were signs that the team wasn't as good as maybe their record indicated earlier in the year. And then once DeGrom got hurt, and Lindor too. I mean, for all the slack Lindor got last year, I feel like his injury was a really big deal when he got hurt. I think as long as the team stays healthy, or gets healthy, I guess, because with DeGrom and Scherzer coming back, and even people don't talk about it, I feel like the bullpen will be helped a lot if Trevor May's healthy and he can give them some innings at the back of the bullpen.
Holderman pitched really well.
And he's healthy now, I think. They just sent him down. I guess they'll bring him up next chance they get, next time they need an arm, which I've been really impressed with him. I think Colin Holderman is going to be a stud for a long time in the Mets bullpen. But yeah, I agree with you. I think this team is just, it's different than in years past. And that's easy to just compare it to 2007, 2008. I mean, you could actually compare it, I guess, to last season and the season before when you have similar players. But for Mets fans, that'll do that, and compare it to 10, 15 years ago, that just doesn't really make any sense.
I was going to say, I feel like the fans have more trauma than the players do about like past Mets seasons. You know what I mean? It's like, we remember, but like none of these guys were there.
Oh yeah, of course.
Some of them are our age. They weren't aware of the Mets. So it's like, we're aware of these things. And, you know, players are aware of the team's history. But I feel like in terms of that level of like past collapses, like I feel like the fans are way more aware of that than the players are. I might be wrong about that, but that's the impression that I get.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. How many players on the current New York Mets grew up as New York Mets fans? I don't know the exact answer to that, but the point is that if you didn't grow up as a Mets fan, your awareness of that, you know, postseason angst probably isn't as high. And if you're a player and, you know, experiencing being around players, you know, you learn this, the focus is on that day. The focus is on the day after that. is so much of being successful in professional baseball is going one day at a time and controlling the things you can control on that day. Nobody in the Mets clubhouse can control what happened in 2007. Nobody in the Mets clubhouse right now can control what happened in 2015, really. It happened already. It's done. But they can control what happens tonight at Citi Field or tomorrow at a different ballpark and ultimately what happens in October. And so that's the focus. And I don't think there's any dwelling or even consideration of the history of the franchise when it comes to trying to win the game that night.
We're all trying to stay level-headed. Yeah, not get too ahead of ourselves. You know, obviously we want there to be a great result in October and September and the months before that. But yeah, you don't want to like lose sight of the journey and like appreciating each game. And even just going back to like the broadcast, like we were saying, just, you know, one of the reasons Mets fans love watching the games is for the team, but also for the broadcasters that we get to listen to, like watching, you know, the SNY broadcast, I'll turn on the game if it's like 9-0 and I haven't been watching just because I'm like, oh, maybe they'll read the media guide. You know, I'll like listen to the radio just to see if like, you know, how he's telling a fun story or something. And so kind of to bring it full circle, because we're going to wrap up in a sec, but you know, it's, I think it's really fantastic that you have blended in really seamlessly to that pantheon of fantastic Mets announcers that are all at the same time. And I just want to commend you for doing a great job so far. And Jake and I are both really excited to see kind of, you know, where the rest of the season takes you, where next season takes you. We hope we hear a lot more from you, because I think you've been doing a great job.
That's very high praise. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been fun. It's been really, really fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jake, so much for coming on this week. We'd love to have you on again in the future. Like Elizabeth said, you've been awesome. And we look forward to hearing you on WCBS the rest of the season when you're filling in, and hopefully a lot more after that. So if you could just let our listeners know where they could find you on social media, we'd love that. And yeah.
Sure. Well, thank you both for having me. This was a lot of fun. On social media, it's at Jake Eisenberg with an underscore at the end on whatever platform you're trying to find me on. For some reason, I've been trying to get my name without the underscore for years, but there's this Russian Twitter bot that hasn't tweeted since 2013 that's taking up at Jake Eisenberg, and try as I might, it's just a really strong hold on that handle. So Jake Eisenberg with an underscore, that's where you can find me, and hope to see you guys around and get to know more Mets fans along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And as always, listeners, you can find me on Twitter at NYMFan97. You can also find Jake on Twitter at Giblin_Jake. And of course, please follow our podcast at Cohen's Corner Pod. We post all of our episodes on Twitter, so you can find them there. And yeah, thank you guys so much for listening. Looking forward to hopefully podcasting about a great Mets summer. Like Jake said, just taking a deep breath, enjoying it. Baseball, see, I miss baseball so much when the season ends that like it's hard to fathom me being annoyed during the season, like when the season's over. So let's just all enjoy the rest of the Mets season and see what happens. So thank you guys so much for listening. And as always, let's go Mets.